When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In this second edition of The Murder of Biggie Smalls, Kathy Scott delves behind the scenes to pore over police records, coroner reports, FBI files, and interviews Biggie's mother, Voletta Wallace, to reveal new facts surrounding the gangster rapper's murder. The notorious B.I.G. exploded onto the hip-hop scene in 1995 with his platinum-selling album Ready to Die. Biggie Smalls, born Christopher Wallace and performing as a notorious B.I.G., grew up in the Bed-Stuy neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, where he dropped out of high school to pursue street culture and his rapping style. Biggie began emceeing his original raps, which were discovered by producer Sean Puffy Combs, who took Biggie's gangsta image to the next level. Fame followed two successful rap albums earning millions of dollars, a 1996 Billboard Rapper of the Year award, marriage to R&B singer Faith Evans, a public affair with rapper Lil' Kim, and hanging out with Tupac Shakur. The high life for Biggie tragically ended March 9, 1997, after a Los Angeles post-awards party where he was gunned down in a drive-by, much like friend-turned-enemy Shakur 6 months earlier. 24 years later, L.A. police still have made no arrests. Despite their early confidence that the case would be solved quickly, and after revealing identities of persons of interest who worked for the police department, they dropped the investigation before it ended, stalling the case. Best-selling true crime author Kathy Scott shares it all in the second edition. The book we're featuring this evening is The Murder of Biggie Smalls, the second edition, with my guest, journalist and investigative journalist and author, Kathy Scott. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview. Kathy Scott.
Thank you very much, Dan. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me again. It has been a fair amount of time since we've spoken to you. I want to ask you, you talk about in this introduction in the second edition about the amount of time and effort you put into this. Tell us a little bit about some of the work you'd put into the first edition, and now even more work and research into the second edition, and tell us how you came to be the author of The Murder of Biggie Smalls.
Well, Tupac was, I'll try to keep it short, but Tupac was killed in 1996, shot in a drive-by killing, still unsolved. 6 months later, they were rivals, and there was the famous East Coast, West Coast rap war that the two of them were, you know, rivals in. And 6 months later, Biggie Smalls was killed in a very similar fashion, almost to a T. It was almost intentional to make it look like a drive-by, similar to Tupac's. And lots of mistakes were made at the beginning, lots of confusion, and the Rampart investigation of corruption at the LAPD was going on at the time, and they kind of had their hands full. And it never, the case, you know, I started interviewing people, of course, from day one, because, you know, I had done the Tupac case, and it was just a natural for me to go into that. And they wouldn't give up the autopsy report. The county wouldn't. They wouldn't give. I mean, I interviewed detective after detective. I went to L.A., went to Van Parker Center, which was the LAPD's headquarters, and they just weren't coughing up any information. It was odd it almost felt like they didn't want to solve it. I love a challenge. So I go after it. So I interviewed a ton of people.
You talk about that you were in the throes of writing about Tupac Shakur, your book about him, while at the same time, this March 9th, 97, when Biggie Smalls was killed in this drive-by shooting. So let's talk about this March 9th, 1997, just about the drive-by itself, Christopher Wallace. But we have to go back to the day before and the award show where he is booed on a stage. So let's just go to that event, being booed, and then we can go backwards in time to talk about Shakur, Tupac, and the shooting at the Quad Studios, which seems to be the impetus for all of this.
Right. Yeah, not the impetus for the murders, but the impetus for the East Coast, West Coast rap war. It did start at Quad Studios. But as for the day before, Biggie was supposed to be a presenter at the Source Awards, and he was, and lots of infamous and famous rappers and, just entertainment people were there, and, singers and performers. And he usually got a warm welcome, you know, wherever he went. And if P. Diddy was there with him, his producer at the time. And he stood up, and he was excited to go, and he had told his mother in a conversation, because I did interview his mother. And he got up, and he was booed, but it was California, and they were, it was East Coast, West Coast rap war, and that was a result of their alliance and allegiance, the fans, to Tupac. And there's Biggie from the East Coast, and had been staying there for a month, you know, recording with Puffy Combs, and he was on their turf, and they weren't happy. So he just worked through it and tried not to let it bother him, but it was almost an omen of what was going to happen next. I don't believe the East Coast, West Coast rap war itself is part of it, but I think it helps to cover up the crime.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So on this March 9th, 97, you talk about this automotive museum where this event is going to be. So talk about the museum itself, and then about the plans for the after party.
Yeah, I went to the museum, by the way, and, went there. They were up on the second floor, I think, and it's an automotive, Peterson Automotive Museum, real close to Cedars-Sinai Hospital, just a few blocks, and where he ended up. But so that it's weird, because the parking lot, you enter it kind of on the side and in front of the entrance, and part of the park they went into, Biggie and his entourage, three cars, went in all suburban jams, and they went into the parking garage. It was full. So they kind of went down the street and parked on the street. There were lots of LAPD off-duty cops there who were seen before and after as they were walking in and as they were walking out. So they had to walk down the street, and they were very visible. You know, he was a big guy, well-known, and they always have an entourage with them, you know, bodyguards. And off-duty police officers were the bodyguards. And so they make quite a splash when they go in and out, so it's easy to be seen. And then they have the party, and the police break it up at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock, whatever it was, or firefighters break it up because it's too full. Too many people are there. So they opened all the doors and had everybody leave. And they walked out. You know, there was a huge crowd, and got into their car. And in order to be able to, or their vehicles, the Suburbans, and in order to be able for someone to then pull up on the right of them, the person was watching, had someone on the ground, had to be telling him, okay, go, they're there now. And then he was in the middle car, Puffy Combs was in the one in front of him, and they were at a stoplight waiting to turn and onto Wilshire Boulevard, I believe. Fairfax, I think they were on, and boom, 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 car comes out, you know, arm sticks out the window and shoots into the passenger side. Like Bonnie and Clyde, you know, rat-a-tat-tat all over the car. And I think it was, I'd have to remind myself, I think it was two bullets that hit him. And of course, it was a chest wound that did it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the bodyguards? You say they used off-duty police
officers. Well, the bodyguards were in a car. Yeah,
they were in a
car, Inglewood Police. I think they kind of got in trouble afterward. I interviewed the Inglewood Police Department too, the head people, and they were in a car. They were in a car behind, and they took after. Supposedly, they left the scene and took after the it was an Impala, dark colored Impala S. I forget what year, and kind of a vintage cherried out car. And took off, and they didn't catch him. They took out after him, but they didn't catch him, which I found rather unusual for police officers to haul after a vehicle right on its tail and lost him. And I don't know if there's anything in that, but, you know, the people, you know, who are accused, one person at least, there's another who is accused of being a part of it and ordering it, hiring the person to do it, was a police officer. And there were LAPD, and there were LAPD officers who, you know, Biggie's cousin remembered seeing them. They all, you know, these guys were blood, some of them, and they were, you know, members of the Piru blood street gang, and they're cops. You know, they were cops on the LAPD force, which is sort of an interspersing of those sort of things. They do overlap, unfortunately, back then. It's as if there were two police sketches as well. One was done from witness at the scene, a couple of them, and a police sketch artist, you know, did this drawing of the shooter, and it changed, and a second drawing was done with no name attributed to it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You talk about, too, that this Orlando Anderson was spotted at this party. Now,
right. Who
is Orlando Anderson?
Orlando Anderson is the one police have said the Compton PD at the time, that's now a defunct police department, the gang cops on the street. I spent a lot of time with those gang cops. And they, Orlando was all over the place, bragging all over South Central that he had shot Tupac before Tupac died. And then he stopped talking. He stopped, you know, bragging about that he was the one who shot Tupac. And Orlando Anderson went to Vegas with his homies and an uncle to see the Mike Tyson fight. He didn't have a ticket to get in, so he's waiting in a lobby, near the lobby, for his friends to come back after it was over. It was a real quick fight. Tupac and his entourage spotted him leaning up against the wall spotted Orlando, and Orlando, they'd gotten into beef with him 2 months earlier, one of Tupac's homies. And so Tupac and his friend and Suge Knight, Tupac's producer, all started beating him up. He was on the ground. They're kicking him and pouncing on him. Orlando, you know, did not want to press charges. And then 6 months later, he ends up at the Peterson Automotive Museum to enjoy the party there. But he was also, Orlando had a studio in Compton, apparently in a garage, and he was starting to rap. And so he was trying to hang out with rappers and that sort of thing. So the motivation on his being there is coincidental, I think. I don't think there was anything connected. It was just an odd circumstance.
Let's get to the
idea
that...
He didn't have anything to do. Orlando didn't have anything to do with the murder of Biggie.
Okay. Despite what the police have said.
Well, police, they interviewed him because he was there. Or not, you know, they looked into it, but there wasn't any evidence that they did have evidence on someone else who the shooter was, and a friend of the shooter who was there as well. So, but they did look at Orlando and came up empty as far as Biggie Smalls went.
Let's talk about the Quad Studio shootings and the origins of this East Coast-West rivalry, because as you write in the book, Sean, Puff Daddy became a mentor for Biggie Smalls, but Tupac Shakur had already was already a successful rapper and had a career, and was also reportedly friends with Biggie Smalls when Biggie Smalls was just beginning. How does it get to the point where Quad
Studios... Go ahead, sorry.
Sorry, you talk about Quad Studios. At that time, Puff Daddy and Biggie Smalls were at one of the floors, probably the fifth floor, and there was five floors in this Quad Studios. And a person named Booker called Tupac to be able to have him record for somebody named Little Sean. So he was calling and calling and finding out when Tupac could arrive with his entourage and safely get him into the studio without any fans interfering or anybody knowing that he was there. Tell us more about this Quad Studio shooting.
Well, Booker was, you know, he was on behalf of Little Sean. You know, Tupac had agreed to be a backup singer for him in one of his songs. And it was something, I think, that they do for other fellow rappers and performers. They perform on each other's records. It makes them, makes a record sell. And so Tupac was late, and he had his cousin with him, and I think there were four guys, but he was late. You know, he was very late to the studio, and they had rented, Booker had rented studio time. So when you're not at a studio on time, you're paying for it. And so he kept calling Tupac, where are you, where are you? It wasn't because, hey, I'm going to set you up and try to get you killed, or shot. It wasn't that. It was that he was anxious, where the heck was he? Because they had a studio time and time is money at a recording studio. And so he finally came up, and Biggie Smalls happened to be there with his backup crew, recording with, and Puffy Combs was there, Sean Combs was there, his record producer, and so Tupac didn't know Biggie was going to be there, but that doesn't matter. It was a popular, recording studio for rap artists. So Tupac gets there and they're wearing jewelry. He and his buddies are wearing jewelry all over their necks, hanging off of it. And this, from everything I can surmise, I went to Quad Studios, interviewed a manager there. I also went to the Manhattan police station that was, that was investigating the case. They only investigated it for a week. And they didn't have any evidence. There was a camera there in the lobby at Quad Studios, but didn't have any film in it. And which is typical for places. It wasn't like they had it the day before and they took it out that day. But Biggie, Tupac was in the middle of a rape case as well and had to appear in court the next day. And he felt like once he got shot, so he shot himself. You know that, right? Tupac shot himself.
Right.
Tupac had a gun in his belt that was loaded, in his pants belt. And he didn't have it in his pocket or in a holster. It was in his pants belt, in his pants, basically, with the belt holding it up. And during the scuffle where these guys see them, I think this is everything I've gotten, is they're walking on the street about to go into the lobby of Quad Studios, and these guys see them, and they've got all this gold all over them, and they follow them into the lobby and start ripping their jewelry off of them, just start yanking the jewelry off. And those guys were not, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's been, it's a lot of information, but I don't believe those guys were armed. If they were, they didn't shoot the bad guys. And Tupac, I think it was his cousin trying to get his gun, or he was getting his gun, and his cousin was trying to stop him or something. Anyway, Tupac's gun went off right into his groin, and he lost the testicle because of it. And so he's shot, but not fatally or anything, but it's an injury, a bad injury. And they go to the lobby and they're buzzing. The guys take off who did this to them. All their $35,000 worth of jewelry is gone. And it was like late at night, 11:30. So there weren't, it was Times Square, but not the middle of Times Square. And they get buzzed up, and Tupac is just pissed. He's angry. And he sees Biggie there, and they're all, you can see him afterwards from a TV camera milling around out front Quad Studios when police were there too. And so then the next day, Tupac goes to court and ends up in jail pending this rape trial, and from months earlier. And he's in jail. He's told, hey, Biggie set you up. Biggie was there. He's the one who did it. And Tupac believed it. He believed that Biggie Smalls and Sean Combs set him up to be shot at Quad Studios, even though it was just, it looked like a robbery opportunity. It was a robbery of jewelry. And nobody knew, nobody could give a good description on any of the guys who pulled off the robbery. There was no one, there were nobodies, no one any of the people were associated with. But that's what sparked the hip-hop war, and that's when Biggie and Tupac became real rivals instead of buddies, and Tupac bringing him up on the stage, which he often did. Tupac brought Biggie on the stage. He helped make him famous. And Biggie was upset, about the whole thing, and because he didn't have anything to do with it. All evidence points to, him not. And the police didn't pursue the case. Initially, I thought it was different, but it wasn't. They didn't pursue the robbery case because they had nothing to go on, nothing. And they pursued it for a week, and then Tupac wouldn't talk to them. And they said they dropped it because, you know, the victim wouldn't cooperate. But, you know, victims die and you don't have to have the cooperation of a victim, as you know, to investigate a case. Dead victim,
right.
You don't not cover a murder because the victim's dead and can't cooperate. But there wasn't anything to go on. And they would have been spinning their heels. I mean, I don't know if they checked any pawn shops to see if they could find the jewelry. A lot of it was pretty prominently known, like the death row gold medallion, things like that. And there was always a bounty on one of those. But I don't think anybody intended to kill Tupac that night. You know, the only gunshot fired was his. You know,
you're right about
that's, you know, the beginning. That was it for the East Coast, West Coast. That's where it began.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write that Tupac is publicly claiming that Puff Daddy and Biggie Smalls have something to do with this ambush. And Biggie Smalls is denying this. And Biggie even visited Tupac in the hospital right after this.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very interesting. Now, while publicly that's going on, and in the East Coast, West Coast, Biggie Smalls is considered East Coast, and of course, Tupac is considered West Coast. So in September of 96 in Vegas, tell us about Tupac is supposed to attend a Mike Tyson-Bruce Seldon heavyweight boxing match in Vegas. Again,
yeah,
tell us what was supposed to happen afterwards.
Well, he was supposed to perform at Club 662, and it was all over the radio locally, and flyers were everywhere, so everybody knew about it. That's what they were going to, Club 662. And after Tupac and his buddies, his entourage, beat up Orlando Anderson, then Orlando Anderson, you know, as everything I've learned shows, and they did drive to Vegas in a white, a rented white Cadillac, and the gunman's arm, you know, came out of that white Cadillac. And so Orlando and those guys kept going back and forth. They went down to Club 662 waiting for the white Cadillac, Orlando and his homies, waiting for Tupac and Suge Knight to show up. And they didn't, and there was a line around Club 662 for people waiting to get in, and all the bodyguards were down there, and only one was with the entourage driving to it. And so had the shooting occurred at Quad Studios, which is apparently where they wanted to do it, there would have been a lot of people shot, because so many people, it would have been a melee. You know, and instead they were circling and they saw Tupac, and, you know, his at one point he was standing up in the BMW, you know, he was sitting with Suge Knight, and Tupac was riding shotgun, and he at one point stood up in the sunroof of the car. And so, you know, the windows are down, his music's playing, and they, you know, they had a big entourage, you know, lots of cars, four or five behind them. So they weren't hiding who they were, and Orlando and his homies came up on them on the street. It's just, you know, just one straight, you know, 2 mile trip from Flamingo where they were, and they were just circling, coming back and forth on Flamingo to get, you know, waiting for him, and they happened to see him, and so that's when they opened fire and got him, you know, and opened fire into the passenger. The windows were down, so they could see who it was. They were aiming for Tupac, but, you know, Suge was on the other side, and I think they were probably aiming for him as well, because he was beating up Orlando also. You know, Suge participated in the beating of Orlando. You have to look at gang mentality. And there's nothing organized about it. It's quite disorganized, but it's a twofer. You did this for me. You did this to me. I do this to you. You know, they beat him up, then they went and they retaliated. That's what they do. Street justice, they call it. There's nothing, you know, anything behind the scenes. It was just a moment. They retaliated against him and killed him.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity, Kathy, to stop for a second for our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. If you're a business owner who's hiring, you probably face a lot of challenges when it comes to finding the right person for your role. Like not enough applicants with the right skills or experience, or too many resumes to sort through, yet you need to hire as soon as possible, or not knowing where to post your job to reach the right people. That's why hiring can feel like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along, which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent to over 100 top job sites with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. It's no wonder over 2.3 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. So while other companies overwhelm you with way too many options, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for, the needle in the haystack. And right now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ziprecruiter.com/murder. Once again, remember to go to this unique place, ziprecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we were just talking about the murder of Tupac Shakur after this boxing match in Vegas, and Orlando Anderson, as you mentioned, is the person with the motive. But there is talk that Suge Knight is the actual target. Suge Knight is the actual target of these people, the assassins that evening. Tell us what happens after this shooting.
Well, there were rumors that Suge was, but you know, Tupac was, you know, the window was unrolled, so it was obvious who they were shooting. They knew who they were shooting at, and Suge was next to him. Suge did get a piece of shrapnel in the base of his skull, top of his neck, so he did go to the hospital as well. Suge runs in his car. They leave to get away, and the Cadillac goes in another direction. And two police officers were on the scene, and up above, two bike cops up above in a parking garage right there saw it and ran down. They left the scene of the crime, the shooting. They heard the shooting because they were right there, and they followed Suge's car, and he ended up going up on the median, getting flat tires, hitting Las Vegas Boulevard and the Strip, and ended up two blocks away on the Strip. In the meantime, you know, cars are driving all over the crime scene, and the Cadillac takes off and disappears, never to be seen again. And Suge ends up at the hospital overnight. Tupac, of course, is in the trauma unit. And then Suge does visit Tupac during the week. And the police did not go to Suge Knight's room to interview him. And he checked out the next morning, and they didn't interview him for weeks. And Tupac never regained consciousness. He was in a coma the entire time. So police were not able to interview him. But there was lots of talk, and especially because the East Coast, West Coast rap war, Biggie was accused as well as being a part of it. Well, it had to be Biggie because of the East Coast rap war, East Coast, West Coast rap war. And the media and the music industry really hyped that up, and it sold records, you know, the East Coast, West Coast rap war. And so that, of course, fans and all kinds of people were surmising. There were all kinds of conspiracy theories, you know, surrounding Tupac's murdered, and then 6 months later, you know, Biggie Smalls gets killed. Well, it must have something to do with the East Coast, West Coast rap war, which the people who shot him, the person who shot him, I think that's what was intended, to try to make it look like it was connected. But it was connected by the people who knew, but it wasn't in retaliation or anything like that. Because that was, Suge Knight was accused of it being, you know, for it being a retaliation for Biggie, for Tupac's murder. But that, wasn't retaliation, but it certainly was, you know, I think that Biggie Smalls was Tupac's biggest rival. You know, Tupac helped make him famous, but after Tupac died, then Biggie just, you know, Tupac had a lot of music that was unreleased, and so that has come out since, and he continued to stay very high in the sales, but Biggie was just flying high, you know, after that, and you want to take out one of your rivals with Tupac's music, kill him. You know, that appears to be what happened from everything I found.
Wow, incredible. There was a rumor, though, after Biggie Smalls was killed, that investigators found a financial dispute with a member of the Southside Crips. Tell us about this theory,
yeah,
about this unpaid security bill.
Yeah, and that seemed sort of viable for a little while, but it didn't pan out. They couldn't. What Biggie, when they were in L.A. for 30 days, for about a month, going from hotel to hotel because they were getting kicked out of the hotels, moving around a lot in L.A., but he hung out at the Mob Piru, you know, the Crips Park. You know, they play basketball, you know, a lot of the gangsters do, the gang members do, and so Biggie was hanging out at parks, buddying up with them. Plus, Crips members, his record producer Sean Combs hired bodyguards who were Crips members of the street gang, the Crips Street King, as bodyguards. And you know, they're not trained bodyguards. You know, some of them might be muscular. I don't know. They come in all sizes. But for some reason, he hired them for bodyguarding. And Sean Combs wasn't paying the bill. That was true, that he wasn't paying them. And so the rumor was that, you know, and Biggie was buddying up with them. They didn't appreciate it because, you know, he was from the East Coast and they were on the West Coast and the rap war. And they to get to Combs for not paying the bills, they took out Biggie, but that wouldn't make sense because they that wouldn't have given them any money. You know, it doesn't even make sense why they would do it. And it was pretty orchestrated the way the thing went down, and gang members are anything but organized and orchestrated to pull that off at the Peterson Automotive Museum. That was investigated and it didn't pan out.
Now, by November 2018, you write that retired FBI Special Agent Philip Carson said he had enough evidence in 2003 to file charges against two officers with LAPD over the killing of Biggie Smalls. Tell us a little bit about this.
Okay, and that was, one of them was Dave Mack. His name is out all over the place. I'm not going to put the other name out there. But one of them was Dave Mack, who was roommates in college with Suge Knight, you know, Tupac's producer. Suge Knight was in, you know, Suge Knight, as we know, is in prison now, convicted of murder in an unrelated case having to do with him, you know, hurting a movie producer or trying to harm a movie producer for not cutting him into the Outlaws. What was it? Straight out of Compton movie. Unrelated. But so Suge is in prison, but still, you know, David Mack had visited him recently, I'm messed up on the dates here, but right, they were still in communication, however it was, and Dave Mack Shug ordered, this is what, there's an FBI report. The FBI has no jurisdiction over murder cases. They only have jurisdiction over murder cases if the accused is a police officer. So the FBI was investigating it. And of course, if you investigate Biggie's, you have to investigate Tupac's at the same time to rule anything mm-hmm. out. But they were investigating Biggie Small, Suge Knight and David Mack for the murder of Biggie Smalls and a man by the name of Amir Mohammed. I forget what his real name is. I start the last name is Harold or something. It ends with a B. The last name is a B, Bullets or something. And that Suge Knight ordered it. And David Mack then found the guy to do it and had Amir do it. And he disappeared. Amir appeared. No one could find him. He's a realtor. But they're all gang-related. They're all David Mack was a member of the Piru, apparently. And he served time for an unrelated case, and he may be out. He's not with the LAPD anymore. The LAPD, I mean, the FBI surmised that that was what happened. But and Valletta Wallace had a case against, I interviewed her at length, but she had a case against the LAPD for wrongful death because she believed that members of the LAPD were involved. And she told me and she told reporters that she would never drop the case. She would never go to L.A. again until the police solved the case. And then suddenly, the police drop the case, say they have, you know, they're not investigating the case any longer. They stop pursuing David Mack, Suge Knight, and Amir or whatever it is, Mohammed, mm-hmm. and just drop the case. And it's a cold case now, even though they know who did it. And then Valletta Wallace, Biggie's mother, withdraws her case, and it's dismissed. So I don't know if there was a settlement in her case with the police department that wasn't made public. But it's very surprising that she, after adamantly saying over and over to the media for years, and then the one case was dismissed, and she turned around and refiled. And it's that refiling case that Valletta Wallace dropped. You know, so I think maybe there might have been, excuse me, a quiet settlement of some sort, because I don't see her doing it otherwise. But it's, you know, hopefully at some point another detective will come along in homicide and another chief of police, not there, a new one, will decide to pursue it because, as you know, there is no statute of limitations on murder. So you can't just drop, I mean, you cannot pursue a case, but there's no statute of limitations. You can pick it up any time you want. They could right now, based on the evidence they have. The driver of the shooter drove a Chevy Impala S Impala or whatever, Impala S. And guess what Amir Mohammed had in his garage? That's what he drove.
Yeah.
In his garage. And, I mean, you know, you have circumstantial evidence. You have evidence. He was available that night. He didn't have a good alibi. So it's, you know, all of the parts are there. I mean, you need means, motive, and opportunity. And it was all there. Same with Tupac. So I'm going to write about it until the cows come home, because in both cases, because I believe they're the underdogs and the police could solve their both crimes and especially Biggie's, and they've got everything they need, and it's all laid out in the FBI report. And And there are police reports in there as well, and they're choosing not to pursue it anymore.
You spoke to Valletta Wallace, Biggie's mother. What did she believe about Biggie Smalls and his involvement or her son's involvement in Tupac's death?
She told me that Biggie was really upset that Tupac was shot, and when he died, he cried, you know, and she, because there's this whole thing that, oh, he was in Vegas, and it was ridiculous. The LA Times came out with a story about it. The reporter who wrote that story based on one gang member was fired, you know, from the LA Times. And then they issued a retraction and removed the story from its site, its website. So it was based upon one little gangbanger out of Compton who fed him this ridiculous thing that Biggie was in town and paid $1 million to a Crips member to shoot Tupac. It was ridiculous. And no evidence pointed to that. And she said Biggie was upset that Tupac didn't want to be friends with him anymore. I mean, they hung out together a lot. Tupac would go to Bed-Stuy in his limo and pick up Biggie and a buddy of his. I interviewed that friend of Biggie's who used to ride with them. They go to a corner bar and play foosball and, you know, drink together and just party. And so he would bring them on stage. So he thought they were friends. There are lots of photos of them together, you know, when they were friends. And Tupac bought into that setup at Quad Studios, which was just an opportunity robbery. But when he died, she said he cried, and Valletta did, and said he was always upset that here's someone he thought was a friend turned heavily on him and very publicly. And you know, they dissed each other in albums and records, and it got pretty nasty. And he never forgot it.
Mm-hmm. You talk about Tupac writing about Biggie Smalls and calling him a mofo and saying that I slept with your wife. So he was quite aggressive. And
yeah.
in those lyrics, and the idea that when Biggie Smalls went to Los Angeles and was booed on that Soul Train award show, the idea that you write as well that there was people in that audience that night flashing gang signs, so it was, as some people thought, an affront for Biggie Smalls to be and Puff Daddy to be on the West Coast, especially shortly after Tupac had been killed, as a sign of disrespect. At least that was the story, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and it was an interesting move that Sean Combs decided to go to L.A. so soon after Tupac's murder, because it was a sign of disrespect, and that whole East Coast West Coast rap war. I think that would have died down as time went on, but it was hyped. It was, you know, with things like that, he caused it himself. Combs did, by going to LA, and of course all kinds of rivalry stories were written about it, surrounding it. They got a lot of press out of it, and he stayed for a whole month, and Biggie was actually looking at real estate, you know, thinking about buying a house and living there part time, and he certainly was not welcome. And but it didn't put him off, and we thought he could buddy up with the Crips members. And, you know, Biggie Smalls wasn't a gang member. He didn't hang out with gangs. He sold dime bags on the corner, but he certainly wasn't, you know, he was just a two-bit player, you know, when he was a teenager, you know, selling dope on the streets. And his mom was a teacher, and, you know, she had sit-down dinners every night. You know, he had a nice home. She made a good home for him. And so he wasn't a street kid out all the time. You know, he wanted to wear Raiders gear or something, I don't know, and he hid it up on the roof of the apartment building, and his mom found it because he would change his clothes, He would get dressed for school, then go up, change his clothes because he knew his mother wouldn't let him wear that stuff. And so he was trying to be a thug or whatever, but he wasn't. He was just, he was a nice kid. He spent summers in Jamaica with his grandfather. So he had a good upbringing, far, far differently than Tupac. You know, poor Tupac was raised by, you know, she was a member of the Black Panthers, but she was a crack addict. And he, you know, he literally was on the streets at times and, you know, and his electricity would be shut off because his mother couldn't pay the rent or the electricity. And so he really did come up from the streets. Biggie didn't. And that's, you know, that I think Biggie was naive, and I think Combs was naive in going to L.A. pretending like nothing was going on when you're dealing with some really angry gang members, you know, and because Suge Knight, you know, was a member of the Mob Pyro and, you know, had lots of connections, and they didn't appreciate him being over there on their turf. And then the Crips were all ticked off because Combs wasn't paying his, you know, security guard bill to them. And so it was almost an accident waiting to happen.
It's interesting too that they do Biggie Smalls records Missing You with Faith Evans, a tribute to Biggie Smalls, and that video and that song do really, really well. But like you say, he doesn't realize, him and Puff Daddy, that going to L.A. is a huge, huge mistake.
Yeah, I think Biggie Smalls would be alive today had he not done that. Otherwise, you know, the people who killed him, they killed him on their own turf. They would have had to go to L.A. and do it. And however, you know, I think they should have just waited it out. I mean, afterwards, Snoop Dogg, you know, he got a Humvee completely out deck like it was a military vehicle with bulletproof windows and everything. He was scared to death. Sean Combs laid low for a long time. You know, a couple, they were afraid, well, if it happened to Biggie, it would, Tupac, it could happen to us. And so that's why it's so surprising he let his guard down. They felt comfortable enough, and they went into that turf. And you know, it wasn't their fault that they went over there. There was no, you know, Tupac, Biggie didn't do anything wrong. You know, but I do believe the people who did it tried to make it look similar to Tupac's murder, which is why I wrote about it, because they were so similar. And that's why the media just picked up on it big time, because, you know, another very eerily similar crime happened 6 months later. You know, they have to be related. That's basically what, and that's what the killers wanted us to believe.
You talked with Valletta Wallace. How successful were you in convincing her of your ideas about Biggie Smalls' murder?
Oh, I don't try to convince anybody. You know, I have opinions, but you don't necessarily see them in my books. You know, I mean, I don't come out and say that I believe that that's what it is. I just lay it out for the reader to decide. She told me what she thought, and she was very adamant about who she thought killed her. She thought immediately it was related to the police, because people were talking to her. She had, you know, Tupac's best friend and cousin who was at the scene, and those guys are, you know, they're all connected, and everybody's feeding her this information. It turned out that the information was correct, according to the FBI reports, that it had to do, that it was related to Suge Knight and David Mack and Muhammad. And that's laid out. It's been written up in all kinds of newspaper articles and analyzed and everything else. And the police were ready to indict, and they dropped the cases, you know. And so it's an interesting turn, but no one could convince her that it was unrelated to the police department. That's her firm belief. And she had that fairly early on because of everybody talking to her. And she's different from Afeni Shakur, who, you know, may she rest in peace, Tupac's mother, who died a few years ago of a heart attack. But Tupac's mother, if any, was all about his legacy and his music, and she wasn't concerned with the conviction of someone. You know, he was gone. This is who he was. She wanted him to live on. And whereas Valletta is all about solving his murder. That was her purpose. And it's quite different from, I'm sure she wants his legacy to live as well, but that was a Fanny's move from, she formed the foundation and kept him out there. You know, that was Fanny Shakur's, that's her legacy as her son as well. The letter's all about getting justice.
Mm-hmm. You write, too, that Valletta had said, too, that despite what Puff Daddy said about being such a friend to Biggie Smalls, that she said they weren't really friends, they were just business associates. She really said that Biggie Smalls was the person supporting her.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, she's very defensive about that. But, you know, it was P. Diddy who pulled him up off corner rapping. You know, he was just cutting some tapes, and I think you did it on, I think it was on tapes at that point, and he had a friend who got it to somebody, and Combs got it, and it was Combs who initially took him under and put him in the bad boy list of rappers and made him famous, and then Tupac helped make him bigger than he was at that point. But he you know, he did owe his career to Sean Combs, he and other people helped him along the way as well, but you know, he put his all into him, Combs did, because he put a lot into Biggie, and you know, Biggie worked hard as well, but I don't think there's any love lost there, but I think that Biggie looked at Sean as a friend. And Sean, of course, you know, if you heard that song after Biggie was killed, Missing You, it's just, you know,
right.
I tear up listening to it. It seemed like it was from the heart. And yeah, he was his big money maker, and he made a lot of money off of him. But they considered each other's friends, and maybe Valletta didn't know from Biggie how good of a friend he was. But I do believe they were friends. She said, you know, basically she's saying her son was self-made, but he wasn't. You know, it takes a village.
Yeah. It's ironic that his names of his records are Ready to Die and Life After Death, and certainly there was a life after death for the record companies and for the fans, and also for the support system that he has for his children, for his ex-wife, Faith Evans. In death, as very much like life, he was providing for his family, wasn't he?
He was. In fact, he was. He did. It's interesting, the life after death. It's almost prophetic, you know, the albums. But Faith Evans was married to him. They had drawn up papers for a divorce. Biggie had the papers, Valletta told me. He never signed them. So Faith Evans, in her, which is incredible to me, she was the heir to his money. And she is a mother of two children. She's a mother of one of them, right? And she gave Valletta Wallace her son's estate, which was incredible. People do not do that. And that was said, mm-hmm. So you have to give her cred for that, was incredible. And she continued to see the children, spend time with them. They spent weekends with her, holidays, and anytime she wanted to see the kids. And she has a good relationship with Faith to this day. But Faith did her a big, big, you know, deal in giving her half of that estate, which has allowed, she stayed in Biggie's Teaneck, New Jersey home, a condo he had bought. And that went to Faith as well. And that's where Valletta lived. She moved into it after her son died. So Faith Evans was incredibly generous to Valetta Wallace. Mm-hmm. It says a lot about her, I think.
Yeah.
And it was, she did what she knew. Yeah, she did what she knew Biggie would have done. And, yeah, it's quite a legacy, they all. There's not the negativity as much with Biggie as there was with Tupac.
I have written The Killing of Tupac Shakur, and you've also written The Murder of Biggie Smalls. So you've covered this case. Now this is the second edition of The Murder of Biggie Smalls. You've been immersed in this case for quite a while and done remarkable research to be able to find really the truth of this story.
Thank you so much, Dan. Yeah, I mean, I hit the ground running. I was woken up in the middle of the night with Tupac's case, and the same thing with a Philadelphia Inquirer reporter called me the night that Biggie Smalls was killed for a comment, and that's how I found out. And I hit the ground running on both cases, mainly because they're unsolved and they're so solvable. And that they're the underdogs because they're not solved. So I'm proud to be a biographer for both Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur because their books are truly biographies and not just true crime books. So I'm happy to be their biographers and tell their stories.
And you've done an admirable job. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about The Murder of Biggie Smalls, the second edition. Thank you so much, Kathy Scott. You have a great evening.
My pleasure.
For those that might want to take a look at your other work, you have an Amazon page where with the other 12 books that you have, at least so far. But do you have a website that people might take a look at?
Yeah, KathyScott.com. It's being worked on, but KathyScott.com. And they can find me on Facebook. I'm everywhere. So thank you so much, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Kathy. You have a great night. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.